move to the fourth case this morning, Crossett versus United States.
Good morning. May I please report? This case is about ineffective assistance of counsel. Mr. Fawcett defense counsel allowed him to plead guilty without a plea agreement after defense counsel failed to investigate the facts relating to his involuntary intoxication. Involuntary intoxication would have served as a defense at trial, Mr. Fawcett's only viable defense, and separately would have served as mitigation at sentencing. This prejudiced Mr. Fawcett. Mr. Fawcett therefore requests that this court vacate his plea and his sentence and remand for trial, or at least vacate his plea, his sentence and remand for a new sentencing hearing. At the very minimum, Mr. Fawcett requests that his case be remanded to the district court for the evidentiary hearing that he never received. The first key reason that the district court should be reversed is that Mr. Fawcett's defense counsel did not conduct a reasonable investigation. At the time of his offenses, Mr. Fawcett was taking a substantial quantity of psychotropic medications, which were prescribed to him by doctors, many of whom were later indicted and pled guilty for various felonies.
Counsel, I understood your argument to focus in particular on Ambien and Abilify. Is that correct?
Those are certainly two of the more troubling prescriptions on the record, but there were a number of other prescriptions as well, Your Honor.
Well, what was he taking at the time of the offenses?
It varied over time. According to the PSR and the revised PSR,
I'm looking at the Medicaid list of prescriptions, and Ambien and Abilify don't show up until months or a year later.
My understanding is that he was taking certainly Lunesta, and I'm apologizing for some of these the generics, but he was taking, I believe he was taking Adderall, Paxil, Xanax, and Trazodone, at least for part of the offenses. They're over the state of a couple months.
But I thought your strongest argument, frankly, from the briefs, was based on side effects of Ambien and Abilify not related to interactions with alcohol voluntarily consumed.
I believe that is the case, Your Honor. I believe that my understanding, and I don't want to be incorrect on the record, but my understanding is that he was taking Ambien and Abilify from these doctors at some point. And if I'm
at some point, that's true. They show up on the list in October and November. Well, Ambien zolpidem tartrate shows up in October of 2010, months after the second of the offenses, and Abilify seems to show up first. I'm looking at short appendix pages 78 and 9. Abilify shows up in March of 2011. So it doesn't look like either one of those could be relevant here.
Well, if that's the case, Your Honor, I would submit that nonetheless, he was taking substantial quantities of other psychotropic medications.
Was he a patient of that doctor?
Was he a patient of? He was a patient of the Wagner Medical Clinic for the duration. So these prescriptions extended before the time of the offenses and after the time of the offenses. So he was a prescription of various doctors, including Dr. Marilyn Wagner, who is, I believe.
All the prescriptions were out of that clinic, though.
That's my understanding. There may have been a few here and there that were not, but the bulk of his medication, the overwhelming bulk, as I understand, came from his clinic.
I was just, with regard to Judge Hamilton's question, there was no option to buy it illegally, for example, on the street.
I'm sorry, that.
No option to buy it illegally on the street rather than through the doctor getting prescriptions.
No, he had to go to the doctor for these prescriptions.
Counsel, I know our time is limited. In your reply brief, if I understood you correctly, you were suggesting that the Federal Defender's Office was ineffective because it failed to detect the criminal activity of these of this defendant's doctors?
Your Honor, I don't think that the case hinges on that one way or the other.
That's an extraordinary claim.
No, I think it's diagnostic of the fact that, and this is in response to the government's argument that there is simply no factual way that they could have, that there were any red flags regarding the Wagner Medical Clinic, and I think that's inaccurate. I think even if the Wagner Medical Clinic had been perfectly professional doctors prescribing according to medical norms and taking the best interests of their clients to heart, he could still have been involuntarily intoxicated because he's taking a lot of medications.
By which medications? And let me be very specific here, okay?
Yes, sir.
The claim here is a failure to investigate adequately.
Correct.
And I understand our case law, please correct me or point me to other threads in our case law, to require that such a claim to succeed show what an appropriate investigation would have shown.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, yes.
So what do we have here?
Well,
showing actual involuntary intoxication.
We have Mr. Fawcett's averals from the very beginning, his statements that he was suffering memory loss, suffering from impaired cognition that obliged him, that it made difficult for him to work, that obliged him to drop out of college. He has said that from the start. It shows up in both of the PSRs. We have indications that he was taking a substantial quantity of medications. It is, I think, indicative of the fact that those medications were problematic, that they were prescribed by the people they were prescribed by. And that might have been uncovered by investigation, but the main point is that he was taking all these medications and he was suffering significant memory issues and cognitive issues at the time.
He has claimed that. But a defense counsel confronted with this kind of a record needs to make some tough choices. And the defense counsel in this case opted, in essence, to argue for mitigation and repentance, right? And acceptance of responsibility. What would the evidence have looked like to support a true slamming winner of an involuntary intoxication defense here?
What it would have looked like would have filled in some gaps that frankly exist in the record, and that's why we ask at a minimum that he get an evidentiary hearing. Because to the extent the court is not satisfied with what is in front of the court, I think those are things that could have been and should have been developed by an investigation, that they would include a more detailed analysis of precisely what medications he was taking, what the interactions were, and how they contributed to his offenses.
Okay, well, that circles back to my point a moment ago. Ordinarily, I thought to make a claim of ineffective assistance based on inadequate investigation, you have to show what a sufficient investigation would have shown.
Well, and I think what we have here are an indication on the record very clearly that he was taking a lot of medications that very probably there's a reasonable probability that they affected his actions and led him to commit the offenses that he committed, or at least contributed to them, which is a weaker standard under mitigation. The defense counsel had the records in front of him, but there's no indication he ever looked at
them. What evidence is there to suggest that the combined effect of these medications, or any one of them on its own, essentially rendered him temporarily insane at the time of these offenses? This is a species of an insanity defense, diminished capacity defense. He has to, and that, the burden is on the defendant for that kind of defense. It's a very steep hill to climb in almost all cases. And it requires the defendant to show that because of this condition here, the involuntary intoxication, he's unable to understand the nature or quality of the acts he's committing or appreciate their wrongfulness. We have nothing to that effect here. That requires expert testimony.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree to the extent that I think there are substantial and troubling facts on the record that indicate that he had no prior convictions for these sorts of offenses, that the offenses were out of character, and that he was taking all these medications. But to the extent that I was
for him, and was showing no indication of this, is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry, that he...
During a period of time that he was taking it, he no adverse indications of things?
No adverse indications of the medications, Your Honor?
Yeah, no bad.
There is nothing on the record that tells me that, Your Honor. I don't know, but I don't see anything on the record. As to the question of whether or not the evidence is sufficient, I think, one, that I would point out that for mitigation, the the causal link is required is significantly weaker. It requires only a contribution, not sole causation. And to the extent that this court finds those facts unsatisfying, I would suggest that that's the result of defense counsel's failure to, as far as we can tell, review the records or consult the medical expert.
Well, no, but it's the habeas petitioner's burden to demonstrate that this investigation would have produced a viable defense. And on the record we have here, it's clear that it would not have, because we're not being told that, you know, what he was taking at the time he molested his granddaughter, and over the course of a long period of time that he amassed this massive collection of child pornography, that he was insane for that entire period of time. I mean, that's what he has to show. That's what a viable defense of his nature would have to show, that he was in a psychotic break for that entire period of time.
Well, in fairness, I think it would have to show that he was unable to appreciate the wrongfulness or nature of his actions at the relevant time.
Right. With respect to the child pornography conviction, that's over a long period of time when he was amassing this massive collection. And at the time of the molestation of the granddaughter, where the evidence shows that he was very calculated about how he did this.
I'm not certain that I agree that the evidence shows that he was very calculated about it. I see that my...
Well, you can answer the question. Have you finished answering your
question? No, I have not. I think that, again, I would stress that there is a difference here, even to the extent that this court is dissatisfied with whether or not Mr. Fawcett's met his burden for the insanity defense. There's a much more forgiving standard for mitigation, and that I believe that what we have put in front of the court certainly suggests that mitigation was a real and that this was perhaps the most compelling form of mitigation, and that it should have been put in front of the district court and never was.
Do we know over what period of time the charged images, or the images in the charge, over what period of time they took?
I don't know for a fact how long the images that related to the possession charge. I don't believe we know that. The production charges were separated by, I believe, about a month, maybe 3 weeks, and there's two instances of those. If there's nothing else, I will.
Okay, thanks, John.
May it please the court, Brian Wright for the government. Fawcett has not shown, one, what this investigation could have discovered that would have been a defense, two, what should have spurred his attorney to engage in this investigation, or three, any prejudice. Starting with those in reverse order, even if this would have been a viable defense in this case, it would have led to only an instruction, and to accept this defense, as I think Judge Sykes, you pointed out, it would require the jury to accept that over a year, Fawcett was insane, but yet functioned in society otherwise, and that insanity only manifested itself whenever he viewed child pornography or his granddaughter was there. This is simply not a viable defense. Moving back to the investigation, I think this maybe is maybe one of the most problematic things with what his attorney should have done, because there is nothing about this case, whether the crime, his client, or the further investigation, that indicated to his attorney that more investigation should have taken place. First, the crime. We know that whenever William Marsh took over this case, he had a client that admitted to a year-long interest in child pornography. He admitted that he methodically positioned his granddaughter and took 59 pictures of her. He remembered specific factors and facts that he conducted during that. So there's nothing there about the crime.
What period of time, similar question I asked you, holding counsel, what period of time did that take, those 59 pictures?
The 59 pictures that he took were on two different dates, the two times that his granddaughter stayed with him about a month apart. He also admitted a year-long interest in child pornography, and during that point in time, he viewed child pornography online and downloaded it and shared it. So there's nothing about the crime itself that would have indicated to any reasonable attorney that this needed to be investigated further. Then you have Fawcett admitting to the police that he remembered specific details about his crimes, molesting his granddaughter, the production of the child pornography. Therefore, there's nothing about his client that would have indicated to any attorney that this is an investigation that needed to be conducted. Now, moving on, his attorney actually did investigate, as even Fawcett admitted. He obtained thousands of pages of medical documents. In viewing those, he realized that Fawcett was abusing alcohol and to self-medicate himself, which would have automatically taken him out of the realm of involuntary intoxication. So there would have been no reason to continue this fruitless investigation. Moreover, there's been no indication that anything facially about prescription medicine would indicate that further investigation is required. So I think Fawcett is really here asking for a blanket rule where any attorney that has a defendant taking prescription drugs must do this investigation without any other reason to engage in that investigation, which is really a broad blanket rule asking for fruitless and futile investigations for no purpose.
Mr. Reitz, can I ask you, was alcoholism offered as part of a mitigating argument in sentencing in this case?
Yes, I would direct the court to pages 6 and 7 of docket 35 of the sentencing memorandum. The defense counsel did push alcoholism and pointed out that Fawcett had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous while in prison, and therefore he was a good candidate for rehabilitation, which the district court accepted. I think that is really a fatal point to Fawcett's sentence mitigation argument, is that really these were contradictory claims on sentencing. You can either accept responsibility and show remorse, or you can claim that your capacity is diminished. And included in the first part, you can argue that, as Fawcett did, I will never commit these acts again, I'm remorseful. But you can't really do that if your capacity is diminished based on ADHD, on his depression, his alcoholic abuse. So his attorney had two choices of sentencing, and his sentencing choice was very effective. He received what this court called a substantially below guideline sentence of 30 years when his guidelines were life. So there is no way for Fawcett to show deficient performance or prejudice when it comes to sentencing. And I think for both, we're left at a stage where there is nothing that's been established here that will show what the investigation could have or should have established. So there's no reason that Fawcett's attorney should have engaged in this futile investigation. And there's really nothing about any of these points that a hearing could further flesh out, be it the palpably incredible defense requiring insanity over a year that only manifests itself in a specific way, or nothing to show what and why that his attorney should have engaged in this investigation when there is nothing reasonably suggested by crime, client, or his investigation into the prescription medicines that would have indicated this involuntary intoxication defense was viable, especially in light of the fact that Fawcett's attorney engaged in this investigation and determined that Fawcett was using alcohol, which would, again, remove him from the realm of involuntary intoxication.
So, Mr. Reitz, I want to give you at least a bit of a hard time about one aspect in your brief. Page 14, you said courts have consistently held that child pornography crimes are general intent crimes, which is one of the legal issues being debated here. You then cited three non-precedential decisions from other circuits, which at least suggests to me that there is a gap. You're not supposed to cite those if they're from our circuit. You can do what you want with other circuits, but it suggests to me that there's a gap in precedent on this point.
Well, I think it's clear to say maybe there's not unanimity about that. I think the general consensus, as what the district court relied on, is that it is a general intent crime. Again, I don't think this technical nuance about specific or general intent crime is what this court needs to decide on, because again, there's no reason for this investigation to take place. That being said, I do think the general consensus.
Right, that may make a difference in cases or claims of voluntary intoxication, which is that kind of defense is meant to undercut the mens rea element of the offense. We're in the domain of insanity defenses, essentially. It's an excuse defense or a diminished capacity defense, which is different and I think applies to both specific and general intent crimes.
That's true, and I do want to answer your question. I just want to say I think this is sort of far afield from the things this court needs to decide. However, involuntary intoxication has been used in a diminished capacity way too. I would cite this court to Fazzini, where from this court's precedents, where the defendant was making a very similar claim that he was unconscious based on intoxication. He was using that to combat the mens rea. This court treated it as a diminished capacity So I think there's really some discrepancy in the circuit courts how this defense actually works. Now, I know that Fawcett seems to now be more targeting to insanity, and in that case, I would agree that that distinction doesn't actually matter, but to the extent that it's treated as a diminished capacity, which it has been in other courts and in this court, that would be relevant. But again, I think that's far afield from the questions that really matter, that Fawcett cannot show prejudice. There's no reason for his attorney to engage in this investigation, and he has still not shown what this investigation could have or would have shown that would have placed him in the involuntary intoxication realm. If there are no further questions, we would ask this court to affirm the district court without hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I'll give you another minute.
Very briefly, I want to point out, I want to stress that at all points in the 2255 proceeding, Mr. Fawcett was pro se. He was proceeding pro se. And it's not clear to me how he would have gotten the very evidence that we need, which would involve medical analysis and would involve the sort of thing that an evidentiary hearing could answer and could clear up. And indeed, an evidentiary hearing could also hear testimony from Mr. Marsh, from defense counsel. Those are both things that would transform the record and would provide Mr. Foster something that at proceeding pro se he could not provide. Quickly, I would also point out that he was charged with both possession and production. And the defense and the mitigating factors might apply to one and not to the other. There was a different time frame. There's different ways that that plays out. There's different factual questions. And simply, to the extent the court is skeptical of its application to one or the other, I would point out that there is a possibility that it would apply differently to a different one. And lastly, we're not seeking a blanket rule. We're seeking a rule where there are significant red flags on the record and medical records in front of the counsel that there should be some indication that counsel reviewed those records and allowed and made an informed decision and allowed us trying to make an informed decision. Thank you, Doris.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.